Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, so all this is meant to be informal, conversational. So if you want to ask questions during the talk, if these guys don't mind, I encourage you to. Literally, if things come up, just hook up. So fun.
Cool. So thank you for having us here. It's great to see a good crowd. So the topic of this talk is you two can be a radio host or how we scale the .NET startup. And the presenter is myself and Rob Blackin. So just a little bit about who we are. Previously I wore more of a security hat. I joined the company about a month ago to build the next enterprise audio management system. Before that, I headed security, compliance, and some infrastructure work at Guild Group companies. And before that, I had different type of development roles in Goldman Sachs, Oracle, Microsoft, where I mainly focused on building enterprise software for identity management, single sign-on authentication. And originally, I come from an academic background. I did my PhD in a combination of cryptography and distributed computing. So security and scaling large systems are two topics which are close to my heart. Rob is a VP of development at BlogTalk Radio. He's been at the company from the start, built it from scratch. Before that, he was a CIO of VoiceNet, so he's going to talk about some fun architecture scalable stuff. So, this will be kind of a dog and a pony show, us presenting together, so...
You can decide which is which later.
Yeah, you can decide which is which later. So, let's begin. Let me give you some background about the company. And we're going to start high level, give you some background about the company, give you kind of a demo of what the product looks like, and then we're going to actually drill into the code and show you some fun technical stuff. We're a startup. We were founded in 2006. There are about 30 employees and about 10 people in technology team under me. We're going to double in size in terms of technology and the rest of the company by end of next year. Originally, we started as a consumer-based platform, BlogTalk Radio. And the basic idea is that, you can pick up your cell phone and you can dial a particular number and host your own radio show. So, for example, if you're in Egypt during the unrest, you could just dial a particular number, host your own radio show, people can dial into the number and communicate with you, or they can just online log into a particular web page and listen to the conversation online. And after the show is over, you can tweet, you can put it on Facebook, you can blog about it. So we're essentially a media creation platform. Originally, it started as a consumer-oriented site. Millions of people are listening to what we do. Tons of people have already used the site to host shows. Deepak Chopra is going to be hosting his show soon on our site. Anderson Cooper has appeared. President Obama has appeared on our site. There have been lots of people using the site, millions of people. And right now, we're also branching into the enterprise business, so more towards businesses like IBM, SAP, Sears, WebMD, who want to use our platform to reach out to their customers. And this is a syndicate product. That's a complementary enterprise product which we're developing, and the approach is slightly different, right? It's an enterprise product, so the focus on security is more heavy. We architected it in a slightly different way. But then both this side, BlogTalk Radio and syndicate, are built on top of the same technology, and it's underneath .NET technology. Some more information before we get to the fun stuff. So, here's the site. We had 4 million unique visits in February 2011, 15 million streams, tons of ad impressions. We make money through subscription fees and advertising. And for the SageGuest site, the basic idea is, you can use your iPhone app or Android app or the regular phone to produce a show, to record a show, and then upload it to your company's website. So, for example, one interesting use case we're dealing with right now, Shell, the gas station company, they have a program called Shell Dialogue, and they're talking to us about how they can use our platform to reach out to people in Nigeria who don't necessarily have access to high technology. And at the same time, you can record the conversation and put up on their website. Essentially, that's kind of a high-level overview. So now on to the fun stuff, which is the actual demo, which Rob is going to give and show you how our platform works, and then we can drill into the actual technical architecture.
Okay. As Alex said, you can call in using any phone. So before I came up here, I called in with this phone. It's on speaker right now. I actually called in for the show. I want to show you over here. We'll switch over to our studio. So just kind of thought up for a second before. This is our studio, where you see I'm already called in as a host for my cell phone, so everybody knows my cell phone. You can play audio files. There's one here, Angry Young Man. Just hear it through my cell phone. So through here, people can call in, like if you want to call in.
Yeah, so for example, you know, this is a phone dial-in. I'm going to dial this number. Feel free to do the same if you want. Live as we're doing it. 866-347-215-8686. Well, luckily it sucks. 215-8686. So we'll give it a shot.
Right. So we said this is a 3-hour meeting, so just in case we talk too long, we can cut it off. Allow people to dial out in the studio, and I can put him live on the air. I put him here. I can screen him. So we've got all this telephony back end all tied in with the web here, so people are using our studio to help, they can upload audio and play it. You can have hundreds of people called in, screen them, all kinds of out-dial people. If you're calling a guest in Nigeria, an out-dial guest who can't call in. And then we have all of our hooks into the social network. Like right now, this is actually being streamed out on Blog Talk Radio. And those of you just called in, you can actually should be able to hear me through this. But I'm going to tweet. Right now, I just put Twitter. I linked this to my Twitter account, and I'll click send. And this will push it to twitter.com/rblacken, R-B-L-A-C-K-I-N. So you'll see that tweet. If you click that link, it'll take you to our episode page of this show, and you can even listen to it streaming right now if you wanted to. So that's one of our core technologies. So like Alex mentioned, there's two sort of products that we have. One is this, which is a long form doing a talk show. The other is a short form where we have an iPhone app for our Cinch FM product, which you can take a picture, record audio, and it pushes directly to website. Or you can automatically go to Facebook, automatically go to Twitter. It's all tied together. So there's a Cinch app here, and I can click record. Or in 3, 2, 1.
And then while I was talking, I mean, here's a simple example why it's really attractive to a business. A company like a big financial institution, they will invest in the
next. There we go. Here we are at the .NET meetup.
Right. So when people call into the investor relations call, the company pays 15 cents per minute for each caller for operator assistance call. So if you have thousands of people dialing in, for 1 hour, you're talking about 20, 30 grand that they pay for the investor relations call. This would cost us, $200, maybe $100 to save that cost.
What is your bus back?
We'll show you the architecture.
So we recorded it. I click next, and then I can tell it to post to Facebook or Twitter, which I won't do. I can put some text in here. I can also take a picture to associate it. So I can take a picture of y'all. Bye, everybody.
If you don't want that girl, we're going to upload it.
Hey, your eyes were closed. So I can then
see the caller is screened out at the mouthpiece.
If the caller lost his number,
yes.
Then it's not going to appear, but he's going to be able to look at it and see it. But you can do different type of moderations, yeah, right? I mean, you can bring people up on the air, you can put people down, meaning take them off the air, you can do various types.
Pushing it from the app to our back-end web server to in the REST interface, and then it's going to get processed, converted from AIFF format into MP3, and then poof, it will show up on the screen. So, anybody? Okay. Push.fm. And here it is, top here, Jay Gloster. Jim is with us here at his account, the .NET Meetup. There's the terrible picture I just took of you guys and playing the audio. My computer's muted, you can't hear it, but playing the audio from it. So it's a really easy way to do short form, and people can reply to pinches, they can follow people. The whole social network is there. Any questions? Except for what's the telephony, which we'll get there. All right, switch back to this. And
cool. So, I mean, let's talk about technology and the challenges we faced in building the startup. As always, building the technology is not kind of a 0 to 100 miles. You make mistakes along the way, you go back, you correct yourself. So let's start high level and then dig into the architecture. So in general, the approach I advocate in my team is as follows. First of all, there's a famous manual for teaching pharmaceutical salesmen, and they have a quote, "Be brief, be bright, be gone." And that's a movie about pharmaceutical salesmen, which wasn't particularly great, but my wife made me watch it some Anne Hathaway in it. The moral of the story is keep the meeting briefs, be on target, have something valuable to contribute, and after you've set up, be gone. So that's the basic moral of the story, and a lot of companies just love to have meetings after meetings after meetings, and obviously us being a startup, we can't necessarily afford to have it. Another point is don't go chasing hot technologies of the day. Instead, mitigate your top problems. What that means is we're going to look at some of the technologies we use. There's some newer versions of technology which we could have adopted, but we didn't because they don't necessarily solve some of the problems which we need them to solve. If you think back a couple of years ago, Memcached was all the hype. Everybody was using Memcached, and people realized some of the limitations, some of the problems, of course, with debugging, and started looking at various other solutions. So it's always, it's always good to know what your core competencies are. Try to innovate, try to pursue different technologies, but don't just do it for the sake of it. I mean, you need to do it to grow the business and to improve your process. Another part is achieve essential, then worry about excellent. I mean, that's my problem as well. I'm a perfectionist, so I like to get everything perfect, which could be a bad thing in a startup environment as you develop the code. It really should be an iterative agile process where you release in small iterations. Be a how team instead of a no team. Very often a job of a CTO is to say no, meaning business people come up with all kinds of ideas and you already have your roadmap on the line and you can't just commit to doing everything. So you end up saying, no, I'm sorry, we can't do it. No, I'm sorry, we can't do this. The approach we're trying to advocate is to be seen as a how team instead of a no team. And I mean, we're still going to say no to people, but we're going to say, unfortunately, we can't get to it because we're trying to push out this particular part of the code, but let me work with you to figure out how we can solve your problem or come up with an interim solution in the meantime. And people usually react much better. I was a CISO for a company before this, so security is kind of key. So building security in the software development lifecycle. A lot of companies have an erroneous perception that security breaches happen only to large companies like Sony, TGX, etc. In reality, they actually happen a lot more often to smaller companies. You just don't hear about it in the news. And part of the reason is that if you're a small company and you get hacked, there's a 70% chance statistic that you're going to go out of business. The other part is by doing simple things, such as, you know, teaching your developers about what all the top 10 secure coding standards are, making sure all the passwords you use in your applications are not hard-coded and strong, you can achieve much better results than spending millions of dollars on specific vendor technologies. I mean, contrary to what vendors would like you to believe. A lot of solutions are simple, and you don't need to spend money to do it.
So technology. As Alex said, we don't use bleeding edge stuff because generally things that are 1.0 or not even 1.0 very often have a lot of bugs in it. When you're trying to run an enterprise level business and you're trying to have things work, like we are very comfortable demoing our studio, demoing this because we're very comfortable with the technology. We know it works. So we like to use solid technology and do great new things with it. That's sort of our philosophy. So, I mean, we're on 3.5, although we're using 4.0 with MDC3 now. So it's one of our new products. We're the CinchCast application we're building. We're all MDC on that. So now continuous build. Everything is manual. It's hard to scale everything, so we make sure we're looking at that. Unit testing is important. Testing is important. Selenium, we try to outsource a lot of some of our infrastructure, like using software on demand for Selenium rather than running it in-house. It's got a lot of nice features. You have to make sure you monitor your site. So there's all these different things that we use. You know, we use Server 2005, although Denali does what they say it's going to do. It'll be great, right? It works great at that. Windows Server, you know, so we're using lots of different technology, and this is actually just a smattering of it. This is sort of the stuff we use, our key stuff, and it's probably a list twice as long as this of other things. So people who work with us tend to end up with a very broad view of a lot of different things. You don't get pigeonholed with like one technology. You end up doing lots of stuff, and our developers often work up and down the stack. So people get a good range of work on this kind of stuff. So some of these down here for performance optimization, AI Cache, I don't know if you guys have heard of that. It's an HTML caching server. Optimize is a software that runs that automatically will combine your JavaScript CSS and automatically sprite images and stuff. So these are kind of mixed here, some of our performance stuff, our development stuff, and some things to try to optimize stuff. In terms of just development, you have Visual Studio 2010. StyleCop and ReSharp are great tools. StyleCop makes sure everything is formatted nicely, so you go to look at any code, everything looks, you know where to find it. ReSharp has got some, I'm sure you guys use it. Got some really slick tools in there, especially it'll tell you right away if something you're coding is written well. It helps especially people who aren't as, I guess, who are newer to the technology as much, but it helps get you programming the right way. Scrum and moving to Kanban, it's interesting. We were for a while, we're kind of migrating ourselves. I don't know if you guys have tried to work more in the real Scrum, you know, sprints, trying to really work just through sprints. As we've done that, we found ourselves more and more migrating naturally from Kanban because when you're dealing with bugs or some things you develop are long range, some of them are short range. It tends to kind of move yourself more to this because sprints kind of constrain you too much. So with business wanting to get things rolling and wanting to roll things in, I don't know if any of you guys have had a similar situation. And Jira is a great tool. And SVN integrates in with it really nicely, works great, and then pulls out nicely using Jenkins. Very nice integrated way of working. Greenhopper is an add-on to Jira that helps you manage Scrum. It gives you tools to be able to do Kanban, be able to do boarding, move things around. It's kind of a nice tool. Any questions? All right, move on. No, we weren't quite getting into, I guess, that level of detail inside that development of it. I guess more about us, what we do in kind of our technology stack. We weren't quite getting into exactly how we code things, sort of more what we use, I guess. So
then for error handling, for
a lot of exception handling and so on, so we log in several places. We log locally to IIS. We have another thread which logs to the SQL database, which is not the most efficient thing, but it's a background thread, so it's okay, in one place. So, I mean, that's really the main thing we use for exception handling. I mean, there's not really much more to it to say.
We also picked up on New Relic, which is performance software.
Right.
We picked up there so we can see reporting on it. New Relic is really. I think
we're
working New Relic. I mean, we just
find out like
that.
I'll show you a screen. I mean, it's a great tool. It allows you to identify some of the bottlenecks in your code, figure out where the transaction processing is taking place. It also shows you some of the exceptions and alerts you have in your application, so it can capture some of this data for you as well. We just adopted this recently, and So there's no perfect answer right to that question. There are a bunch of monitoring tools. You can use Zeno, Zepic, Gomez, New Relic, AlertSight. Every one of them does one thing well, another thing not so well. I mean, there's no perfect answer. I mean, it's a reality. I mean, we're trying to put more tools in place, but we don't want to put too much dependency in the code itself. I want to isolate a lot of the monitoring outside of a site. We're going to log and put a lot of the information to deduce what the problem is if it arises. But it's risky to put too many things like that. Logging is great, but to a certain extent.
And it depends on what you're trying to log, too. I mean, if you're wanting to get alerts on application running flow issues versus hardware, I mean, there's always, you know, like what's up goals and those kind of tools that'll tell you, you know, okay, the CPU is running high, you're running out of memory, running out of disk. You got those, and then the application type of ones, this New Relic is one that was hard to use for alerting us when, you know, there's hotspots and we're seeing when, you know, database spikes because some job is running and we're seeing how it affects. I mean, for us, we want to focus. We have all the what's up goals, we know about the servers, but we're just now getting into this New Relic, trying to really see the application itself and see when is it running slow, what's causing it to run slow, and that kind of thing. It's really going to help us.
I'll tell you honestly, we're not doing it yet, but one thing that's kind of on my roadmap is more, so, metrics.
which is a perfect
kind of, you know, segue into this. So then, we do a lot of work to improve infrastructure, put continuous build-in, write unit tests, do this, do that, put monitoring in place, but then how do you really know you succeed or not? So the analogy I like to use is if you don't do metrics for your code, you're like a pilot trying to land a plane in the middle of a thunderstorm and all your instruments give out. So we are beginning, we haven't done it as aggressively as we should have, but we're beginning to measure a lot of different points and aspects about our application and look historically every few months at the moment to see how we're doing. And we're looking at different things, such as code coverage, site throughput, the number of critical security bugs, and how long it takes to fix each of the bugs. So we have some SLAs in place. We're not enforcing them rigorously yet about how long the critical ticket must be fixed and how many days it must take to fix major tickets, et cetera. In practice, it's not as easy as to say in theory. Percentage of developers using your site, that's a really important metric, right? With some sites, it's easier to get developers to use your site than with others. A lot of the time, developers write code, but they don't understand that the site is being used by actual customers. They don't try to use the site themselves. With some, my developers, correct. Well, actually, a lot of developers. In some companies, it's easier. So, for example, I mean, I worked in Guild Group before. It's pretty easy. I mean, this shirt is $300 in a store. I bought it for $10 because I got it at a bulk cost, which we paid the manufacturers. So, you know, I would log in every evening to the site. My wife wanted to look at this. I would look at different type of clothes on sale because I feel good. I paid $10. I get a really nice shirt. You don't have to force me to use the site. So for a site like Block Radio, where you host your own radio show to talk about things, it's slightly different, right? And then developers are often kind of into themselves. They don't like hosting radio shows. So it doesn't automatically happen. But I do want them to use it. So one thing we're doing is first of all, is we're going to begin using it for our internal conferencing in November. One reason we did not use it so far for our internal conferencing is because we're in the process of implementing a role-based access control system inside. Once we do it, you can truly host a private show, and we can start using it. Another thing we're doing is we're trying to motivate people and kind of reward them. So we're doing a mini competition. A developer who hosts the most radio shows per month, we just started it, is going to get an iPad. And so So then outside of work hours. But, I mean, the point is to motivate people, and I'm willing to reward people just to get them to use the site. With some sites you see here, if you manufacture an ad boxes and your people love games, they're going to play it. But in some cases, it could be a little trickier, but it's really important to get people to use your site, and that's one thing we're trying to keep track of with the metric. So New Relic. So, I mean, here's an example of a metric from New Relic. It measures, how long average responses take, breaks it down by tier, does not CLR database, web external. So by looking at a lot of the information from our metrics and our monitoring tools, we learned a lot of interesting stuff. So, for example, Optimize, which is a minification tool to minify your CSS, JavaScript, and sprite images, we thought it's great. But we started looking at some of the spikes like this, and we realized that in some of those cases, Optimize Request Handler was a culprit. We started looking into more detail at some of the transactions, and we realized that in a lot of our requests, for example, Microsoft Password HTTP module was being executed, because you need to remove it explicitly from your web config, otherwise it will get executed by default. So, we learned a lot of interesting things from measuring data and trying to kind of approach a lot of things objectively. Kind of the next set of slides, Rob is going to look into the progression of an architecture, where we were a couple of years ago, and this is a more technical part of the talk, and how we progressed through years. And I like to compare architecture and building a site to a nice castle. I mean, on the outside, it could look really pretty, but on the inside, it could be rotten, the foundation sucks, there could be a lot of bad things, like the castle is on a mountain, so Fresh Direct is not going to deliver there. I mean, there are a lot of kind of pluses and minuses about each architecture. And the point is, it's not a linear kind of path to success. Almost every site goes through the same type of drawing exercise. So Rob is going to go and show you some of the technical aspects. And the story begins, once upon a time with a single web server and a single database, as in many cases.
Yeah, so I've been here since the beginning where we just had a server and a database. Yes, at least we had two different ones, right? One on the same box. and we had it in a data center that was shared with sort of a parent company at the time that we grew out of. So you start with this and you hope they come. They come. And what happens? Well, you need more web servers because you can't handle it. Database is handling fine, but the web servers did. And as we know, when people are logging into an application, unless you've got very sticky connections, which are not guaranteed, you want to make sure people aren't getting logged out. So we found this product called Scaleout, which will keep session state across all servers. So as we scale, so it was great. So that, no matter which box you hit, kept the session state across all the servers. Coyote Point. So as we moved on and it grew, the one database couldn't handle it. So from there, we started learning about replication. So our one database started replicating to two read-only databases. So we didn't care about backing these up. We just replicated data from there. Read-only things went hit the load balancer because we wanted to be able to load balance traffic, take one out if we wanted to. So we went to the load balancer and we added some more web servers. And, oh, you may notice this. This is Optimize. At this time, when we were doing, as many of you know, we've been doing .NET development a long time, and .NET first started, and even though 2-3 years ago, when this was written, web forms was the way to go, but there was all this great overhead called Houston, and all this great overhead where it created all these JavaScript files within the code for you when you're doing Ajax, the Microsoft's Ajax. So back when we first started doing all of that, we were doing it that way. Obviously, we've changed all that since then, but back in 2008, 2009, that's what we were doing. We got an Optimize, which would automatically combine for us all the JavaScript on the fly and the CSS that got generated by us and Microsoft into one to reduce the number of calls. It's also spreading images, which is, at the time was probably a good win. And we're looking at getting rid of it now, but for now, just at this time, we needed it. So people would come in, they'd hit here, we optimized the request, we got scale out, we've got multiple servers, their style on 2000. Well, then we kept growing. So it got to the point where the bunch of servers we had, well, we had different sites for specializing. Because, you know, if you saw that studio, people who were using the studio didn't necessarily need to be affected. If we had a whole big influx of users at one time, you know, hitting their show, it shouldn't affect their use of the studio. So we split out those web servers. And, oh, by the way, the RSS and bots, because our SEO was doing so well, were hammering us. So we ended up splitting out separate web servers just to handle RSS and bots, and a separate database, the read-only database, just to handle their stuff. So we had the main users, and so we're still going through the little bound here, except for read-only for the RSS and bots. And all that traffic was handled by our load balancers, the Coyote Point. So based on the user agent, we decide where to go based on the apps, we look things up, redirect things, so you're hammering stuff all over the place. Plus, there was some types of traffic that we were driving ourselves, that we were purchasing some traffic, we decided to throw some stuff up on Amazon. And now we're out of our own data center, and now we've got a combination of stuff in the data center and in Amazon. And this is around the time we went to Velocity. If any of you guys have been to Velocity in California, O'Reilly puts it on. Really, really good conference. You want to learn about web performance and how to get the most out of it. AI Cache is running this on Amazon, and it's an HTML caching layer that is very intelligent. Our biggest thing was we wanted to be able to have people who are logged in not hit cache, but people who are logged out hit cache. So because we weren't doing any kind of donut caching yet, we weren't doing any kind of that. So we wanted to be able to have the HTML here and not even hit our web servers if someone's logged out and hitting a common page. So that's what AI Cache is for. So the way this is working is they come in, and based on the user and what they were requesting, they would either come to AI Cache on Amazon, in which case, if it wasn't in cache, it would hit web servers there, and that actually is calling back to our web servers, our database, through the load balancer. So this is where we were last year. All right, go to this year. Okay, this year, we haven't added that much in the way of the servers or anything. Now it's about more specialization. So I didn't have on here before, but we had Limelight as a CDN before, but it was only dealing with our JavaScript, CSS, and images. Now what we're doing is it's using Nintendo's in the CDN we're working with that will actually function a lot like AI Cache, where it'll allow us to intelligently cache objects at the edge and allow us to sort of pass through some traffic. So for the same page, I can sometimes hit cache and sometimes not based on the user, you know, based on information in the header, whether they're cookied or what they're going to. So this is a lot of wins. So some of our traffic that we're throwing at people don't even hit you. I mean, the more you can hit at the edge for anything cached, then our site is very dynamic, so even slow to really do a lot of HTML caching outside of .NET. I mean, we've done, I'll get into the slide about .NET caching, but the HTML that never even hits our servers helps you scale quite a bit. So this sometimes going right to AI cache, depending on the traffic, or to our network. And you'll notice here, I don't have a little A anymore. Through continuous integration processes that we were implementing, we're going to be able to get rid of that. And the way we're writing our code now, the MVC, we don't have that problem where .NET's throwing all that garbage in that you're trying to compress together. So now we can get rid of Aptimize and just compress everything ourselves within the continuous integration, right? So that's gone. That's going to, as Alex said, taking away some of the performance hits we were sometimes seeing on our site. And also, you see here, we've added is we're starting to do more services in order to scale things out further and be able to do coding in other languages other than just .NET, take advantage of what else, we're going more to service. So, like, one of our slowest bottlenecks is search. So we wanted, we're looking at using Elasticsearch, doing search, that's an external process. Authentication, we want to make that external so it could be used across multiple applications and also caching layer, a data caching layer.
Right, so then I know we've got a few time remaining, so I'll try to sprint for the next 5 minutes through a lot of the slides. But just to go back to the services, So just a point on the services. You know, if you think about how a lot of these sites, like Facebook, Guild, Twitter, were architected, for example, Facebook, started solely with PHP. They realized that they reached a particular level of scalability. Then they rewrote different components of different languages, implemented Drift for middleware messaging, and started isolating things into services. Amazon, the same thing. So that's really what we're approaching to. So I'm going to show you a slide about what we're doing, but a lot of the functionality, instead of doing it as DLLs, we're isolating it as services, just RESTful JSON services, potentially written in different languages. So, for example, search is running on Amazon EC2 and using a different technology. But, you know, we are at a point where this really is probably the best thing we can do at the moment. So,
just quickly, this is just the evolution. Stuff we added in 2008, where you went to multiple web servers, Iodium scale out, 2009, read-only databases, replication, we added Aptimize, 2010, AI cache for caching HTML, second farm on Amazon, there was traffic, and more specialization of servers, 2011, Contendo, CDN, services framework, retiring Amazon, and service broker within SQL Server to communicate between servers.
So here's a question. Who wants us to go briefly for 30 seconds into telephony overview of this? Anybody else? Okay, so we'll spend 30 seconds on this, and then we'll talk a little bit more about services.
So essentially, you can come in to host the show to it. You can use Skype or a phone. So we're using a phone right now. So they can Skype in. That comes in through Mastrisk servers that are sitting out there. And then that connects into our Factola server. Or you can call in with a phone number, so that CLEX we're using will then, or TCPIP, connect into our network, and that fits into the Factola soft switch. So you have a Factola soft switch, which interfaces with NFS servers. These servers are for recording the shows, which I didn't think I mentioned, that these shows are being recorded so that Twitter link, to go back to it, you know, tomorrow, later, right after I hang up, you'll be able to listen to later. It also has the files that you upload and want to play, like the Angry Young Man one I played. And then this works with a cluster, a database cluster, and it all in together. So when you call into a live show, it's coming into the area through this here and then back to the Asterisk servers where our streaming takes place. But if we're not a CDN, we don't want to push you now, 10,000 screens to people, so we work through two different CDNs. Everything we do, we try to have a backup. We don't ever want to put all our eggs in one basket. It's possible. Obviously, it's not always possible, but in this case, for streaming, we use two different streaming providers, and those streams will then go and listen to it on your devices and enjoy. For the archive shows, when it's done, after it's done, you hang up, the show's over, the recording, the raw recording that's on here is then grabbed by an archiving server and it converts it into MP3 and then pushes that out to CDN. So when you listen to archive shows, it's not using our bandwidth. So those things get pushed out to level 3, so when you listen to it through our site or through RSS feeds or however you listen to the content, it all comes off of it. Say it again? Yes. Basically, we push both the stream to both of them. So if you're listening to it in the player and you know, Lion White takes a dump. Right now, I mean, we've been looking at creating the changing our flash player to be smart enough to switch that, which we haven't done yet. What happens now is people have to refresh the page, and when they refresh the page and it pulls in, we grab it, it'll grab the new one. So we have, it's more monitoring. We have a ton of monitoring in place on streams, so whenever we find there's an issue with a stream, we flip a switch in there so the next time there's a call, it's using the other one. Right? When that call, that came in through here, and that went into the Pactolus into here, and then, yes. When you called in, you're listening to it through this piece, and you're listening to it on the phone. So then when you go to the web page, that's where you're hearing the stream. That's where you're hearing this piece of it. This is actually a little delayed. I'm sure you can assume when it comes in here and then goes to the Asterisk servers and gets encoded and gets pushed out to here, and then by the time you get it, there's a little bit of a delay. So it depends. It's not consistent. Yeah. 15, 30 seconds, depending on the, you know, the pitch. But that, so that was about 30 seconds? How did you scale your calls?
Because I imagine your big T1 calls scale up based on the marker depth.
Well, a lot of it too is, well, and callers, I mean, we do have a limit of the number of callers we can take in. There are licensing limits and the number of
people on the whole.
Okay?
On the platform as a whole.
And the platform as a whole, Pactolus licensing wise, there's only so many you have to pay depending on the number of simultaneous calls.
Okay.
So we have license, but I don't remember how many we have a license for. But if we hit that license limit, then calls will start getting tested.
I mean, you can have up to 500 to 1,000 users on a conference call. Like, you know, we've had conference calls with that many users. But when you talk about 10,000 users and so on, we have not had that many calls, and you need to and, you know, next quarter, not next quarter, but in Q2, we will be taking another look and re-architecting some of this.
So,
I mean, you can listen as many times as you want. They can be tens and tens of thousands of listeners, but to participate in a call at the same time, meaning interact with a person instead of just listening, that's probably up to about 1,000 interact callers.
We tend to try to encourage people to listen streams.
Right. You probably, if you have the poll, you put it, say, poll, like just poll, it's a discussion, for example.
If it's not simultaneous,
I mean, just automatically, if you poll to this number, call this number, if you would say yes to the question. If you're not agreed with the speaker,
it's something that, I mean, we could technically do, but we haven't done that kind of application at all. The only quick, just quickly, that's in check.
No, the answer, so people ask us a lot of time, like, you know, why podcasts, why not video? And the answer is it's a complementary service. It's not a competitor. Because so think of a video conference. It's not easy to have all of us, it's not easy to have 100 or 500 people participate in a video conference and interact. And we're not trying to compete in that space. So, but it's much easier to have tons of people interact in an audio conference, replay it, do some type of investor relations call with tens of thousands of people. So we don't really, I mean, right now it's not on the roadmap. Some of the things we want to do is synchronize the audio with things like slides, for example. Be able to synchronize slide presentation, some type of images. But video is not necessarily on a roadmap anytime soon.
And a second question?
So,
Cinch FM, the recording I've done that showed up on the website, if you guys are interested in knowing how that works, if not, we'll skip on. Yeah. And Grace, call one if you want to know. Call two. Okay, so There's actually three different ways to record one of these Cinch FM recordings. One is you can call a number 646-200-0000. You record on the phone, hang up, and it shows up in your account. That's one way of doing it. Second way is on websites. You can just go on the website. We have a flash recorder that connects to a Red 5 server. We'll record it, convert it to MP3. Boom. So if you go on cinch.fm, you'll see there's some of them. It tells you where it was recorded, iPhone, website, or phone. Those are the three. Third one is the iPhone or Android app, which is what we did here. And actually, this is all on Amazon. This entire thing is on Amazon. It's not within our data center. So this comes in through the load balancer. And it's one of two servers, right? So with the iPhone app, what happens is it gets broken up into packets. Because if I record something and I want to push a big file across a GSM network, it may keep choking and never get there. So when it gets broken up into small packets, it's going to get pushed to the web server through a web service, and then they get put together, combined together into one file at the app server, which then gets converted into an MP3 and pushed out to a CDN where you listen to it. So this happens. And all that happens on the iPhone app within, 10 seconds. So it depends on how long the audio is. For an audio that's under a minute, 10 seconds it'll be there. If you're recording something for half an hour, it's going to take a little time for it to show, for it to get converted and show up. So I'm going fast because I know we're short of time.
So let me wrap up. A couple of slides. So what we faced in 2011 is we had a lot of spaghetti code, a lot of monolithic code resulting from ASP.NET web forms. So what we're doing right now is we're creating a lot of services, search service, open service. It's still kind of in prototyping stages, but we're seeing quite a few successes with it right now. And what I started doing for a lot of the services, I love reinventing the wheel. I mean, I hate reusing big technologies so I came across this lightweight .NET framework called Martin, which is Martin URL Extractions. It's just about 10, 11 files in the framework. So what I did is I took the framework and I extended it to take an interface. I passed the interface, and it's going to automatically do reflection on the interface methods and expose all of them as URLs. So for a developer who's using it, you just pass an instance of a class, and then what you do right here at the bottom is you say config.register-service, and Monkey. And Monkey is a class which can scream and add two numbers, and you register that at API/Monkey, and then if you go to localhost /Monkey/Scream, that automatically executes the method on the class and returns the JSON message saying data 0, message is A, and, whatever, data found the message. The scream doesn't necessarily return anything. So that's the direction we're heading. Very lightweight framework. Since it's lightweight, it works quick. I don't need any other functionality. And, to give an example, one of the things we're doing is Elasticsearch. And Elasticsearch is a service based upon Lucene, but it's still experimental. But unlike Solr, it scaled really well during writes. So for real-time search, like you start in the show, it scales very gracefully. For example, if you compare if you compare Solr to Elasticsearch, which are both based on Lucene, and you do a search fresh index while idle, then Elasticsearch takes longer, right? Solr is much quicker. But if you're going to index one document every 3 seconds, so in other words, create a show every 3 seconds, then Solr is going to take much more compared to Elasticsearch. And so we experimented with it, but, compared to us hitting a database for search, it's, 3 seconds versus 300 milliseconds. It's a huge difference, and we've seen some improvements. And I was debating whether to write Elasticsearch service. I mean, Elasticsearch is a product, but we wrote a service in front of it. I was debating whether or not to do it in Java, but we ended up doing it in .NET. The class to use it is very simple, right? So you want to search for a particular term, and you want to return documents starting from a particular index to X. And really, the main call is client.search, name of a term, start index max rows, And this is a library which connects to a cluster of Elasticsearch nodes. So it's really like a one-liner, really simple, you know, one-page type of a code. It's not production code, but, you know, it's a simple example of how you could do something like this. Caching, we don't really have too much time to go into it. We did all kinds of different caching. One of them was donut caching, where you cache most of the page except a couple of dynamic regions, like, for example, your name of a user which you logged in, and then later you can look at some of the examples when we upload the presentation. Some full stack projects on the horizon. Do you want to briefly touch base on what we're doing?
Sure. We're trying to do some stuff more on the client side, on the user side. So we want to get listeners keep coming back more and more. So we want to do some customizations for them specifically for the listeners. Like we talked about building out the SLA, is what he's been talking about, all the services.
Every day I come to work, I'm like, oh, I did XYZ. I'm like, did you do the services?
You're learning how to
do services.
Improving our caching, as you talked about, we've done lots of different caching, from all the different kinds of .NET caching. We still have a lot of that in there. We're trying to focus a lot more on the edge caching out of .NET, so it can hit our servers, so it helps scale better more at the edge. So we've been focusing a lot more on that than the .NET caching. And A/B testing. Our marketing folks are really big on A/B testing. They want to make sure they can say, "Is it blue button or red button? Get us more customers." You know, so this new homepage or this new homepage, get us more signups. You know, so there's a framework we need to put in place for that. It's one of our big projects coming up recently.
So to conclude, probably the main point is. Here's what most people think of a success, and here's what it really looks like. So the moral of the story, we made gradual architecture improvements, but we made mistakes along the way. We found out that Optimize was not really the right solution for us. I mean, for a while it worked, but then, it's a nice IP filter which goes into every HTTP request, slows things down, and tries to do minification every time. It's much better to do it at compilation step as a post-build test. So don't chase hot technologies. REST plus JSON is greater than SOAP plus XML. Some of our services are SOAP plus XML, which I'm ashamed to admit in this audience. But, you know, we're changing a lot to REST plus JSON, and my point about be brief, be bright, be gone, just kind of a shameless marketing slide. We're hiring, so, you know, if you're bright and you want to join the team, send us an email to jobs@cinchcast.com. And, I mean, I hate job descriptions. They're all crap because, if you're a good developer, we'll find, we'll find a role for you. If you're interested, feel free to apply. Developers, yes. We decided to outsource QA. With actually good success. But developers, we prefer to keep in-house. But, you know, like iPhone development, for example, we outsourced as well. I mean, because we don't have a need right now for a full-time mobile developer.
Many developers.
So there are about 11 people in technology, and about, out of them, 5 people are developers. So any questions?
We're working on any Windows.
I'm sorry, what's the question?
We're working on the
Windows. No, we're working right now on iPhone. So I should be more politically correct. Not yet. iPhone and Android. I mean, we have iPhone and Android app. We're extending them, but, you know, that's where most of our kind of customers are right now.
Which can enterprise customers have right for it.
It depends on the customer. I'm gonna get myself in trouble if I get myself in trouble all the time. I don't know. It really depends on the customer. I just built the product, right? So it depends, right? So I mean, if you want to host your own blog, talk radio show, I mean, you can go on Blog Talk Radio Show and look at the prices. For, like, short recordings, it's actually free. I mean, you don't need to pay anything unless you go above a particular period in time. For enterprise customers, I mean, the problem with enterprise customers, right, is most of the time it's not like a product, but you also need to do customization. You need to do white labeling. You need to do some integration work. So that's why it's not an entire, right, so it's not like, you know, if you just take a platform and use it, then it's a flat fee. If you have to pull a developer to do X, Y, and Z, that's a different story. So, yeah.
Any other questions?
I'm sorry, what?
Well, actually, one thing I didn't mention, it was privately held. It actually just raised around the funding the last couple of months, $6 million. Just money. Higher is probably one of the reasons we're higher.
Right, so we need to. So, Blog Talk Radio part is profitable, right? I mean, but profitability for a startup is kind of a silly notion because, let's say, you know, here's an enterprise. No, I mean, truly. Here's an enterprise kind of solution, and that's the right thing to invest your resources in. So I can stay profitable and, you know, keep the team or maybe hire another 20 people and eat up into the funding round which people gave me, but in the hopes that, you know, this is going to make the company worth 10 times more, right? And that's a gamble you kind of need to take. So, but, you know, the Blog Talk Radio part is profitable. We got a $6 million round recently, another $6 million round before. So, and the reason for hiring is to kind of build out this enterprise part.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.